The Gambling Files Podcast, the podcast that doesn't touch itself when it thinks of you. Can you hear my dryer?
A little bit, yeah.
Cool. I like to bring like reality into the podcast.
I think it's important. I think people need to know we're real. We're not just like some scripted machines reading our scripts.
Well, if I were listening to the podcast, I would probably think these guys, they're just too slick.
We are. That's the problem, right?
We need to find some way to like fray the end of the rope, you know?
Rough it up a little bit.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
What should we do?
I don't know, just a random introduction to the podcast, probably a good place to start.
How the hell are we going to think of that? We spend hours agonizing over each line.
It's like the Saturday Night Live writing room. So it's all week.
It's exactly what it's like. It's like writing an episode of The Simpsons, but, you know, obviously not as good. And I mean back when it was good.
I was going to say, have you seen the recent stuff's not good?
I haven't seen. I haven't seen any of it.
They are phoning it in and milking that machine.
Oh, well.
What's really funny about the Simpsons kind of come full circle now. So a lot of the in-jokes in The Simpsons are actually referencing older episodes rather than the world.
Well, that might work for me.
So it's becoming kind of like self-referential in a way.
I haven't seen South Park for a little while, but last time I watched it, I mean, that's held its quality extremely well.
Yeah, so I've seen a few, and it definitely had like Family Guy went to shit. It was never great anyway, and The Simpsons just nosedive after, but then it's like, you know, 30 years whatever for The Simpsons.
Yeah, it is quite a while.
They had
20 years of quality.
Yeah, so South Park, yeah, South Park's pretty good, but I just don't have time for stuff like that.
Did you ever see the movie Team America World Police?
I laughed my balls off at that. That was one of the funniest things.
It's a rare treat of a movie, isn't it?
But the South Park movie was also great.
Yeah, that was very, very good. There's a couple of different versions of Team America.
Do you know which?
Did you see the one with the extended sex scene?
I can't. It was so long ago.
It's the point at which the blonde lady says to the hero, whose name's completely gone out of my head. She's like, you know, I would have sex with you right now if you just tell me you'll never die. He just looks at her and goes, I'll never die. But in the first version I saw, the sex scene goes on for about like 6 minutes and they do everything.
Brilliant.
Absolute filth. If it were not puppets, it would have been so banned.
Yeah.
I've probably told you this before, and I'm really sorry if I have, but do you know what Team America was going to be?
No.
This is really cool. Do you know the movie Armageddon?
Yes.
Okay. Now Armageddon is hilariously bad, and it's a great fun film. It's truly awful. But what they wanted to do is they wanted to remake Armageddon with puppets, word for word. And I mean, it's genius.
It would have been better.
It would have been phenomenal. But of course, they realized they couldn't do that. So this is their take on that kind of film with puppets.
Yeah. Well, you know, just like this is the montage song. Like, it was done incredibly well. It was incredibly well.
I mean, even the vomiting scene is incredibly well done.
And then obviously the classic, just the theme song of like Team America, fuck yeah. Like that's become a catchphrase.
It certainly has for me. I'm going to have to start thinking about
teaching the kids. Oh, look, I use like any presentation I do about the US market, the opening slide is Team America, fuck yeah. And it's, you know, machine guns and puppets and everything. That's mine. It's my go-to. Either that or it's like a screaming eagle kind of descending with flames and shit. There's some great clip art once you get into it.
You can get one with fangs.
You could get an eagle fang.
You know, it's branding, that is.
That is, that is consistency as well.
We're kind of co-branding.
Well, it's that kind of like meta, I suppose, because it's kind of pulling in.
We're world building, really, if anything.
That's the phrase I was looking for.
I consider us the Tolkien of gambling industry podcasting.
I think we could easily claim that title because nobody else would ever consider that as a
nobody thing. Else would ever want that.
No, we've made up our own language and written a poem in it that goes on for 6 pages.
Ah, crikey.
And it's all about slot machines.
I bet you are a bit of a Tolkien fan. You look the type.
Yeah, I read it. I read him when I was younger. It was,
yeah, but you know, if you read it a minute ago, you read it when you were younger. How young?
Oh, you know, I was like, I read The Hobbit like when I was 8, and then read Lord of the Rings then around 10. And
precocious.
Yeah, I was a big reader. Well,
as opposed to Precious, it's very similar. It's Gollum with a stammer.
I read a lot as a kid. Just not time anymore. Yeah. But it kind of set you up for. The problem with so the difficulty is that it made other fantasy novels seem pretty shit.
Just that gap between the two, is that because The Hobbit took you 2 years?
No, just I'd started reading Lord of the Rings a couple of times, but it's quite heavy going, and I just couldn't kind of. It took me until I was about 10 before I could actually get into it, and give it the 5 chapters it needs to warm up. Because I'd attempted it a few times, but I just couldn't. And then one day I was just really bored and just sat down and read it. But then it was one of those series like where other like it became such a because I read a ton of fantasy when I was a teenager, and to be honest with you, it was Lord of the Rings and then Game of Thrones came along as a book series. And they were like, oh, wow, this is fantastic. And because I'd read so much fantasy, I could really appreciate Game of Thrones because it was so much better than anything else in the fantasy world that had been written up until then. And then obviously years later, the TV shows and stuff came out. But it was, yeah, I read a lot of fantasy as a kid. Thanks, Roger.
I've only read one George R.R. Martin book.
Yeah, he's done a bunch of other stuff. Like I've literally read his Game of Thrones stuff. I haven't read any of
his. Well, I've only read his Vampire Steamboat epic.
Do you know the story? The Game of Thrones stuff. You know the way, like it's got all the twists and people die and stuff like that. As a kid, he had hamsters. He had a lot of hamsters as a kid, and hamsters have a tendency to eat each other, and that's where the whole. And he was writing and stuff as a kid or as a teenager, whatever. So the whole kind of plot twists about such and such dies or this person murders this person. And he was practicing Game of Thrones with his hamsters at a much younger age with like the plot. And he'd kind of work in a plot twist based on, you know, Fluffy's just eaten Pinky, even though they're brother and sister or something like that.
Do you think there was a point at which he made a choice between being a serial killer or an author?
Well, it's not that he was killing the hamsters himself. They were killing, like they will, hamsters are little cannibals, like they'll savage each other.
Does this also mean that hamsters are really tasty?
I'd say they're mostly bone, right? I don't think there's a lot of meat.
No, but
Once you've shaved it, like deboned it.
There's a South American country where
you need 10 of them on a stick or something.
Hamsters or presumably not chinchillas because there's nothing on them. They're all fur. Although it does floss as you eat it. I'm sure there is at least one country where hamsters are eaten as a thing that's really delicious.
Yeah, I don't know. I could imagine. So you can imagine like a little meatball kind of thing, I suppose. Like
rabbit, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, but there's a lot more. Rabbits are much bigger than hamsters.
Like, yeah, they're a pain in the ass to sort out as well.
Yeah.
How the hell did we get onto this?
If anybody's got any good hamster recipes, please let us know in the comments below.
Yeah, yeah, by all means.
Just curry it and be done with it.
Do you think the recruitment experts from GRS Gaming Recruitment Solutions have ever eaten hamster?
I doubt it because I think they're so busy helping their clients find the perfect candidates around the world for the gambling industry.
Well, that certainly makes sense from what we know.
Yeah. So if you've got gaming recruitment needs, contact Paul or Stephen at Gaming Recruitment Solutions.
What's that web address?
That is grs-recruit.com. Accept no substitutes.
And could you say that message in hamster?
Jesus Christ. I'm out of practice. It's been a while since I've done hamster. I'm trying to think.
Which way you phrase that?
What noise does a hamster make? Do they make noises?
They probably do, and they're being eaten by other hamsters. Sorry, imagine they probably make quite a lot of noise. Let's tweet George R. R. Martin now. What does the RR stand for in George R. R. Martin?
No idea. Presume it's made up. Presume they make it up to make them sound more interesting, right? Fintan X Costello or something like that. Be the trick, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
John Q. Bruford.
The one I always do is F. So, you know, so I went up to Tom Neiman at ICE, and I'm like, Tom F. Newman. And if anybody ever says, what does the F stand for? I'll be like, ask your fucking parents. Jesus Christ, I don't fucking name you. You know, so that's the kind of person I am. Anything exciting going on in the world today? So I'm putting this episode out the same day we record the intro.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I read your newsletter.
Oh, yeah. Any good?
Today wasn't really a banger for me, personally. I'll be honest.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. Fuck.
I think you need to work on your subject lines. I think that's going to get a bit repetitive. But apart from that.
No, that changes every day.
Yeah, but it's like newsletter 80. I think you should do something like a funny play on whatever's in the news that catches your eye.
I would like to, but that means I've got to be creative every day. And you know,
yeah,
what
I could see it. But I can also see a situation where your like little intro thing gets bigger and bigger and becomes the email. So I'm actually quite looking forward to that. You started off quite safe.
Shorter.
No, it's gonna be like our intros. It's gonna get bigger. I'm quite excited about that.
It's gonna get bigger and more people are gonna skip past it. Like our intros.
They don't skip past it. They love the intros. No, you can see the data. You can see the analytics. They stop after the intros. That's the problem. They never get to the guests.
I don't look at the analytics because the
intros are too strong. That's our problem.
You know, it's like one of those things where, you know, you'll end up trying to do the things that you think please people instead of following your instinct.
Because we've got really good instincts. Good point.
Yeah, that's it. We've got really good instincts. Yeah. Totally.
Shooting from the hip. It always works. Nothing could possibly go wrong.
But I mean, it took me a couple of days just to write this intro. Nothing going on in the world. Today's newsletter wasn't very good, apparently.
No. It's just because the thing about the newsletter is there's such a wide range of stories. Not every, like, you're not going to sit there and go, oh, I have to read every story. The trick to your newsletter, which I love, is like you can scan it and go, oh, that one's really interesting for me. And so it's like a little kind of menu and you pick what you like.
But today,
curried with a fried egg on top. But today there was nothing on the menu that I was looking, but I still opened it and I read it and I heard about your news about postponing your event by a couple of weeks and yeah. See?
Couple of months.
Oh, a couple of months. Oh, sorry.
Well, it's probably about 7 weeks in total, I think. Yeah,
it's not long. It's nothing. It's nothing.
But I'm still very excited about it.
You should be. It's a great concept. It's going to be amazing.
Hope so. And it gives you a bit more time to make it even more amazing.
That's the thing.
Good times. If anybody wants to know about it, they can always email me and ask.
They could, or they could sign up for the website.
Well, that'd be even better. Jesus, you're good. They could sign up at www.thegamingboardroom.com, where they can get the daily news digest from the industry, and no talk of hamsters yet.
I don't know. So, I think Kate runs a tight ship, mate. You're not going to get hamsters in there.
Anyway, who's on the podcast?
That is a great question. We've got a brilliant guest. Not that all our guests are brilliant. Don't get me wrong. We've got Ed Dickerson from thegreco.com. Ed is poacher turned gamekeeper, would be the best way to describe it. And he's one of the co-founders of The Greco. And him and the rest of the team were professional bonus abusers, I suppose is the best way to do it. Advantage players for online. Advantage players is probably the best description for it. So tons and tons of experience of monetizing bonuses, monetizing slot games in maybe ways they're not intended to, but it's actually what happens. And now what him and the team do is work with slot providers, work with casinos or sports books, work with operators, I should say, and help them tighten up their bonus procedures to make sure they're not being abused and taking advantage of by those sneaky people out there. But then also kind of, you know, helping operators improve things overall from a bonus perspective, because there's obviously legitimate customers and these kind of things. They've got some really cool products that can identify these in real time. Ed's a lovely man, and I think a kindred spirit of the podcast. He'll definitely be back. This is just a warm-up act. And yeah, we nerded out about bonuses, basically.
Sweet. But that sounds good.
It does. I would highly recommend you listen to it.
I'm sorry I missed it. Just kidding. I was there. But it's just a shame about Cobra Kai. But if you want to know about that, you're just going to have to listen to the podcast. So, Ed Dickerson, take it away. And we come to our first guest in our second episode of the week. We are joined by the superbly pated Ed Dickerson. He is co-founder and C3PO at Greco. Ed, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
As I like to say, you might want to reserve judgment on the pleasure part. Ed, just one quick question about the name of the company. Is it called Greco because you are particular fans of 90s teen heartthrob Richard Greco?
Interestingly, that's not one of the reasons why. And there are many reasons why we're called Greco, mainly because when we took all of the things that describe what we do, we turned it into an abbreviated thing, which is a gameplay risk engine company, so GRECO. And that seems to fit quite nicely. And also, there was another driver that got someone in the company rather excited, who quite likes the Ocean's 11 franchise. And Ocean's 13, in particular, has just a very kind of quick background on the film. It's about a casino heist, land-based casino heist. And this casino has this thing called the Greco, which is a machine that kind of can read everyone's pupil dilations and their reactions and tell whether people are playing in a genuine way or whether they were expecting wins. So it's like this impossible to cheat casino. So it has that kind of really nice tie in there as well. But really, it's just an acronym. It's the Gameplay Risk Engine Company, as far as I'm concerned.
Ocean's 13 was pretty shit.
It's one of the worst films I've ever had to see.
I mean, it's a real shame because it's got, who's the French actor? Vincent, the chap that married Monica Bellucci. He's phenomenal in everything I've ever seen him in, including his first film in which he plays a hate-filled skinhead in the streets of, I can't remember if it was Paris or Marseille.
Oh, La Haine's an amazing movie.
Yeah, it's the lead in that, the lead skinhead in that, the white fella.
That's where I learned all my French.
Wow, I'm not going to fucking France with you. I'll be stabbed to death.
Vincent Cassel?
That's him. Vincent Cassel. Phenomenal talent. And he pops up in that and I'm like, I'm all excited. And it was shit. Tell you a true story though. I have probably shared parts of this story before, but I interviewed the producer of the Ocean's movie franchise, a guy called Jerry Weintraub, and I misbehaved horribly at his Lifetime Achievement Award dinner. But in my defense, I'd been drinking all day. Anyway, so sitting down doing a roundtable interview, which was phenomenal. I mean, he was a hell of a man. One of those people that you meet and you just think, yeah, you know, we are all created equal, but you are considerably better than me, even allowing for that. And I just remember one of the foreign press journalists on this roundtable saying, so when they black out everything on the strip, this is obviously Ocean's 11. How did you do that? And he said, oh, I just phoned up all the casino owners. Just got them to switch the lights off. Okay. Anyway, sorry, Ed.
Sometimes the directory works, right?
Fuck yeah. So you're the C-3PO, which means that you are everything in that board except for the CEO. Two things here, right? So what we've got here is we've got a Venn diagram of sorts.
Okay.
Maybe it's not a Venn diagram. Maybe it's just two circles that don't intersect at all. Because you're a C person and Fintan's a C person. And I mean that as in a bored person, not that forbidden word. And you and I have no hair and Fintan has it all. So maybe we're just like, maybe you're the Venn diagram and Fintan and I are just in two distinct groups that you bridge.
It's entirely possible.
A lot of people on here with hair.
I don't want to put myself in a bad light and make judgment on people with hair, but that's a shame.
Do it. Do it. I do it all the time.
He judges me all the time.
It's the reason I'm here sometimes. Nice hair. That's the issue. If you just had hair.
When Fintan and I met at ICE for the first time last week, as mentioned in the previous episode, we hugged, and I said in his little ear, I said, I thought you'd be taller, and then I mouthed to his colleagues behind him, the fucking hairy bastard.
They didn't tell me that.
Well, maybe they can't lip read.
No, it explains why they were laughing. I'm sure that's exactly what they've called me a few times in the last few weeks. Makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense.
So, Ed, what does Greco do other than acting as a tribute to former 90s teen heartthrob Richard Greco, of course, star of smash straight-to-video hit Teen Agent?
Well, we'll skip over the wrestling aspects of what we do. We're essentially a form of fraud prevention, I guess you would say, but completely different to any other kind of fraud prevention. It's all to do with gameplay analytics. So we look at, from a really, really granular level, every single bet that a player makes. We're assessing their play for various different risks under the broad umbrella term of what we call bonus abuse. We're looking for all of the behaviors and markers of bonus abuse, flagging those behaviors in real time, understanding the true value of the players by understanding the value of the different behaviors, and making operators' lives really, really easy by taking that burden away from them, because traditionally they don't do very well at it.
I have a lot of questions.
Oh, good.
So
what are they? Is it about the happy life that you can live without hair?
It's not. I don't really think about hair a lot, John.
Oh, you all blasé with your warm head.
Just like completely. It's a very small part of my mental load. I want to get to the Greco bit and the games and the exploitable stuff, because I think that's a fascinating subject. But what I'd really like to talk about is, like, you don't just wake up one day and go, hey, let's create this business. I think I've got an idea. I think we could figure it out. The vibe I'm getting is this is a poacher turned gamekeeper situation. So I'd love to know the backstory that brought you here.
This is the question we've probably been asked the most, actually.
And, oh, I thought it was being original. I'm rubbish.
It's a shame.
I'm formulaic. So, I'm shite. Oh,
whenever we start talking about the product and what we do and how we do it, it becomes blatantly obvious that the reason we know everything we know to such an expert degree is because we lived it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very much a poach turn gamekeeper thing. And I think whenever we kind of do research, we do kind of looking into different fraud products, looking into different bits and pieces. The best fraud products are the ones that are run by people that used to do fraud. The best white hat hackers are the ones that used to be black hat hackers. It's just, you know, to be an expert in the things that we do, you can't do it. You can't start from the other side. You can't start being a BI analyst in an operational team, look at big data and know everything, because when you're looking at big data, you can see the trends. If you know what all of the behaviors are, you can see the behavior if one or two people are doing it, but you have to know what the behavior looks like in the data first. So we have a very much an approach of know everything we know inside out, know exactly what the behaviors are, what drives them, what they look like in data, how and where they exist in what different systems. And then we can build around those behaviors in a way that no one else can to make sure we can recognize them all in real time. So it's very much that.
Are you allowed to tell any stories from the glory days, or is there still a statute of limitations issue?
I have no idea. So we'll just talk about it anyway and find out later. So really, I guess I'm going to make it clear that I don't think I've broken any laws, but I might be wrong.
Fair enough.
So, you know, I used to have an ordinary day job, right? I used to work for a telecoms company, ordinary stuff. And then I heard about through the company I worked with, I heard about this guy that left the company. I was checking on how they're doing after leaving and heard they're making guaranteed profits from bookies and casinos. I'm like, hey, do you know what? I'm good at maths. And you're wrong. You can't do that. And then I heard about it again. I was like, do you know what? I don't know what you're on about. It's silly. Then I left that company. I'll skip the sad story in the middle. Started for a new company. And on day one, my new boss said, hey, can I have your details? Can I have like your personal details, KYC documentation to pass to my friend who will give you some money so he can make some guaranteed money off the casinos for you? I was like, well, this is the third time I've heard about it. Send me some details. I'll look into it. So I looked into it. Got sent a website to have a look at, pen and paper, worked out all the maths of it. I'm like, holy crap, this works. This is a legitimate thing. So overnight, I put all the money in my bank into all the different bookies and casinos, made an instant profit, started telling all my friends, hey, check this out. It's a legitimate thing. A couple of weeks later, I'm making more in the evenings than I am in my day job. And I'm like, well, this isn't obvious progression. I need to put more time and money into this. I'll quit the day job. Do this full time. And then you kind of go through the motions, right? You go to all these different bookies, all these different casinos, you take their offers, you make money from them one way or another. And then over time, you start making less money because the casinos are kind of welcome offer heavy. You tend to get bigger offers at the start, smaller later on. And some of the more savvy operators can kind of tell that you're rinsing them a little bit and they'll stop giving you bonuses. So over time, the money you make from it goes down. So you're like, well, okay, do you know what? That's not a big problem. My partner doesn't gamble. I'll sign up in their name and I'll gamble on their behalf and give them a cut of the money. It's like, well, okay, this worked again, worked a treat. And then you start kind of going through, okay, well, how can I do this again and again? And so it's quite normal for people to have their close friends and family to gamble on their behalf. Some people take that kind of way above and beyond, and they're setting up pyramid schemes. They're doing like Facebook marketing campaigns to recruit additional identities where they pay them just £100 one-off thing. They'll take their identity and go make thousands from it. You get people that someone I know, they got their personal trainer at the gym to recruit identities for them. Someone else I know was a driving instructor that would recruit his students. But you get people that go around university campuses and just, you know, it's crazy, right? But when you can make that much money that easily, you can understand why that happens.
How much of this was like matched betting versus, so for those that don't know, so match betting is where like you take a welcome offer bonus from a bookmaker and then you, particularly in the UK, you can lay it off on an exchange so you can kind of lock in a profit. How much was match betting versus like just, you know, smart casino gameplay on wager requirements and stuff like that?
That's it. I think for everyone or for most people, it starts with match betting because that's the really simple thing to learn. The logic of it is simple. The process of it is simple. And you make guaranteed profit on every single offer you do. Like, it's just an easy way in. Yeah. And then you get to the casino stuff, which is a bit more complicated. You can't guarantee profit on every single offer. It's like an averages game, right? Over time, you will, the favor's very much in your favor. You will make mm-hmm. profit. But it gets a bit more complex. And then anything really from then onwards becomes really quite niche and specialist. And so the masses of people that do match betting and the basics of bonus abuse, most people just stick to that basic stuff. Some people like me, the kind of geekier ones or those that are a bit more driven to make good money from it, find about these kind of hush-hush things, these little things you can do that are way more efficient than the other processes of converting bonus funds into cash. And this is things like finding exploits in bonus engines, where you can trick a bonus engine's logic into thinking bonus funds are cash. Really, really kind of stuff you would assume isn't possible, right? There's a technological system in place to prevent this from happening, but they're not too smart. And many of them you can cheat one way or another. And then you have content like we call them exploitable slots, but the slots are not exploitable. They have features which make bonuses exploitable. And you can use content to do the same thing, to convert bonus funds into cash in a way that a casino can't see about it. And there's all these different kind of tips and tricks you can do to make it more and more efficient. And that's where it starts getting really quite serious and professional, and then the knowledge you've found out from your own research is kind of yours, and you feel protective of it, and that's where the real good money is to be had. So then you get all these little groups of pockets of people which are kind of experts now, trade secrets, this kind of stuff.
So because it's like if I for anybody who's seen like the back end of an online gambling company, like it's a shit show, right? So they've got different suppliers plugged into a platform. Every, say, game supplier is recording data in a different way. You're assuming there's no mistakes made. So it makes sense that stuff like this could happen, given how messy it is and how many different game suppliers will integrate with an operator, particularly the bigger brands. What's fascinating, like, how do you test for that? Like, how do you, like, to actually sit there and kind of figure out, okay, there's a, if you triggered this bonus round and press, you know, A, B, C, up, down, left, right, you trigger a thing. How does that work?
Like, sometimes people just stumble across things. So like, they didn't do it intentionally. It just happened. There was one casino that we used to use, and the joke was like, you just sneeze and the money just turns to cash. You don't know what you did. You're just trying to play it genuinely, and all this bonus just starts converting itself to cash. You don't know why. But some of it, you have to kind of know what the common, there are some common things that tend to happen from one site to another, and you can test for those or variations of those. And it's all to do with all these different systems. They all work in similar-ish ways. And so from kind of the player side, you can kind of brute force test different strategies and find something that works. And if you find one thing that works, if you've got 100 different identities you can exploit it with, then you can try 3, 4, 5 times and lose money trying to find it. As soon as you find it, you make a profit, right? But now, obviously, our side is we kind of very much supporting the operators, right? So we can do it through testing, and we'll have a really solid process of doing that kind of penetration testing now. But really, it's just a case of, we can often just speak to the people that designed it and be like, what happens in this scenario, this scenario, this scenario, this scenario? And that they'll explain the ins and outs. It'd be like, well, you probably have an issue here and here and here. And it may or may not be being exploited, but it's exploitable. It's just a case of testing, really.
So if we're going to work through the journey, so you've identified a potential thing, you've tested it on a bunch of brands, you found, okay, on XYZ it works, you then scale up with the hundreds or thousands of accounts, and then obviously you've got the withdrawal process. So like, because I presume it's a bit like money laundering, like where you want to stay below a threshold, particularly if you're winning. And then you've got to make it look like if 1,000 accounts show up and immediately all win $1,000, it's, you know, so there must be like quite a lot of logistics and magic around like managing that as, okay, how do we hide it as a normal distribution? How do we, you know, surely, like, how did that work?
So when I used to do bonus abuse, I was never in that kind of position that I only had a handful of accounts that I could gamble with, literally my nearest and dearest. I didn't trust anyone else. Sure. And that was part of the reason for transition. In fact, it gets to a point where if I'm to scale this further, I've got to start doing some things that I'm morally not comfortable with. Yeah. Right? And so that's part of the reason for switching. But when we analyze casinos data and we see some huge syndicates, exploiting a particular process, it does seem to be very, very systematic, which is the right word.
With American audience, with UK,
bit of both, right? In that they'll have a very kind of typical approach. They'll have a few accounts which are like the scout accounts that will be testing for A, B, and C. Like, can I use this exploit and get the withdrawal processed, and can I make a profit? And they'll try all sorts of different things. You see the wackiest gameplay behaviors and they don't make any sense. They're just looking for these exploits. And then they'll be like, okay, so technically it can be done. Now I'm going to start scaling. So they'll start, like, I'll put 10 accounts through on day one, I'll put 20 accounts through on day two, and they'll scale it up a bit and a bit more. And so you find with the tier ones, they'll be putting hundreds of accounts through on a regular basis, like new accounts being put through, and they'll be off the radar because the company's so big, it's just a drip in the ocean to them. It's not worth the time to look at it. And then you get smaller operators where if you did that volume of abuse, it would be all over their radars. They'd be going absolutely nuts.
They've never had 50 accounts in a day in their lives. Kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so not only do they see, like, oh, do you know what? This marketing campaign is going spiffingly well. And we have 10 times our normal signups. And then 6 hours later, they're like, they're all winning. What's going on? And it gets, you know, so it needs to be kind of a managed approach, I guess, from the fraudsters. But really, they're all just honing in on the fact that operators, especially the bigger ones, the volume of traffic they have, it can't really be done manually. You can't manually check everyone's withdrawal. You can't check everyone's gameplay. You need automated processes, or you need reporting flags to be coming up to show you where the abuse is. And that's when it comes down to a situation where their fraud team's only as good as the knowledge their fraud team has, or their operational team has, or the capabilities of their systems. And the industry is, there are some good, really good operators as well. But broadly speaking, much of the industry, their data sucks, their platforms suck, they don't have the capabilities they want to have. They'll have fraud teams that have been screaming for help for 5-10 years, saying we need this, we need this, we need this, and it doesn't get implemented. When we used to do consultancy, we'd be like, here's 2 or 3 of your biggest issues, here's some others there could be. They're like, okay, we can fix this and this and this now. This other issue, this involves all the stakeholders, lots of different departments, loads of development. We'll probably put that in the roadmap for 2 or 3 years away. It's like, but you're losing millions a year to this. Okay. It's crazy that they'll know they have an issue and roll with it because it's the easiest thing for them to do.
Yeah.
So most of these exploits come from a lack of visibility due to the data, poor systems that they just literally can't control the issues, and just a lack of desire to resolve things sometimes.
Got it. That's absolutely fascinating. So you talked about syndicates. So syndicates, I'm guessing, are like professional gangs that just do this at scale, or like are we talking like Ocean's 11, or are we talking three kids in a bedroom type stuff? How big does it get?
All sorts. And it really changes. It varies depending on the jurisdiction, right? In the UK, it's really quite common to have what we would call multi-accounting. So it's where one person recruits the identities of other people and bets on their behalf. So they will have all the KYC documentation. They will have control of all the bank accounts. They would do all the gameplay themselves, right? And that's what we would refer to as multi-accounting. Whereas syndicates, I would describe as a little bit different, where you typically have like one ringleader that has all the knowledge, all the processes, and they will still recruit other people, but the other people will use their own, they'll be directed on where to sign up, how to play, how to withdraw, and be told all the processes, and they will do it themselves. And so that becomes then a little bit different. And that kind of what we call kind of ringleader syndicate setup is more common in countries where you have like social security numbers, you have the kind of data that you wouldn't want to share to other people in any situation. That's where that syndicate becomes really quite common. Finland is probably the the place where we see that set up the most. You know, America is, I think, also going that way as well. Obviously, America's quite new, but the UK is very much all about multi-accounting on the most part, you know, to the point where back in the bonus abuse days, you'd ask someone, hey, can I get your details to gamble with? They're like, I already gave my details to someone else last week. It's
okay, so it's like
it's a big issue.
How you make. I've got some very close Finnish friends who definitely started off in the bonus abuse world, particularly in the early days, with poker and stuff as well. There was a lot going on there, and I think the US is an interesting one as well, because when you like some of the easy kind of, obviously there's exploitable games and stuff, but just some of the easy bonus management type things like wagering requirements. It's changing now, but like even last year, like there was definitely like 1x wagering requirements on welcome offers in from some brands, like, and big offers. So it was very, very the playthrough was relatively straightforward. I think that's the tension, right? So from an operator's perspective, how do you, so like just transparency, like I run bonusfinder.com, right? So I'm kind of the player, not player advocate here, but like we see from our users, like we're very female heavy. They want to deposit 10 quid and play some slots games, right? So they're just like, they've got a little bit of money and they want to just, you know, get an hour of gameplay or something for their 10 quid. So it's very, very casual type stuff. And we've deliberately gone after that, and it's, you know, it's the vast majority of people realistically. But I suppose the tension for every, and having been an operator as well, the tension is you want to go out with a good offer. You want it to be fair for the customer and give them a good time, and then not get absolutely turned over by a group of Russians, or historically, like it was the Russians would come in and just like clean us out. How do you, like, as an, like based on your experience and kind of how you work with operators, like, What's the sweet spot there? How do you manage that?
There are so many different approaches, and obviously we have our kind of utopia of, you know, if it was my casino, if it's my money on the table, this is how I would do it. But there are so many approaches of how you can do it. Like you get operators that are just like, you know what, overnight we see this big issue, we're just going to basically scrap bonuses. It's like, okay, that will solve bonus abuse. But you know, goodbye to all your KPIs. You're not going to grow, and there's all everything in between. But really, to manage things really effectively and really kind of thinking forward to how it's going to be a healthy business in the future, there's no one way of fixing it, right? It needs a little bit of everything. Your marketing team need to make sure you got offers that are appealing to genuine players, less appealing to bonus abusers, and you have all the right terms and systems and processes in place to manage it. But it's not just about that. You know, I think companies tend to have put blame one way or another. It tends to be blame on the marketing team, or it tends to be blame on the fraud team. And really, there are only two pieces of the puzzle, right? Yes, your fraud team also need to be very good. They need to be good at having firstly the right tools and systems in place to get the right data, know how to view it in the right way, so you can manage people at the point of sign up. You know, if you can manage people at the point of sign up, flag all the people that are clearly trying to cheat you. If you can then have the correct player validation to make sure you don't have some Russian sitting in a dungeon somewhere who's just stolen all this identity, right? If you have these kind of player verification processes in place, then you're not really exposed to that kind of risk. And there are tons of companies out there that do a pretty good job at, you know, that kind of registration risk, payment risk, and player verification. But then it's down to the marketing team and having the right offers that come across in the right way. But where the big kind of gap in the market is, which is the space we're filling, is the kind of gameplay analysis from once a player's live. You know, there's all this money, all this time spent on making sure the right players come through the door. Once they're through the door, you give them some bonuses, you hope for the best, and you've not really got anyone checking what these players are doing and how they're doing it. So it's quite common, you know, for bonus abusers to exploit a site for 6 months, 12 months or forever,
really,
and never be closed down just because no one's looking at it, or you're doing something that's just not on their radar. And so it's crazy. So that's where we come in. We're looking at the gameplay stuff. So we're looking for the behaviors from the very first bet and forevermore. So it doesn't matter if a bonus abuser turns up on day one, they try and cheat, we flag them then. It could be they're a genuine player on day one, and 2 years into their player journey, they've jumped onto a bonus abuse forum. They're starting to learn these tips and tricks. Mm. You know, sometimes we see like a VIP player will sell their account to a bonus abuser or share an account with a bonus abuser. And you'll see a really healthy player suddenly start to either change their behaviors or show some different warning signs. And so really you need kind of all of those bases covered. You need all of the areas of risk managed, the promotions to be good, the automation of these kind of analysis processes, but also to have the systems in place as well that don't have gaping flaws in them. You know, these kind of bonus engine logic kind of issues, or you know, there's so many different reasons where the problems can exist.
Got it. And I suppose the flip side of it as well, though, right? So I've definitely seen situations where casinos have abused the T's and C's to deny payout to legitimate players.
Yeah.
Oh, you wagered more than $5 on a spin, and therefore the entire bonus is nullified, and you don't get like. So I've seen. So this is the. So I get, like, of course, you're running a business, you need to protect your business and not get abused, but it also goes too far.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And I've seen that as well, right? The intention of those kind of terms, like the maximum stake, that they have a purpose, right? They help protect the business, but they can absolutely be misused. You know, we've seen some games on some sites where the default stake is like 10 quid. So if you load a game up, you press spin, you realize 10 quid's come out your balance, you've suddenly just invalidated your whole offer, right?
Exactly.
And one, the system, the casino should have physically prevented you from placing that bet if it's outside of the terms. And two, if it's just a single bet, and then so you've done £10 of wagering that's against the terms, and then you've done £9,990 of wagering within the terms.
Doesn't matter.
That's fine, right? But some casinos will be like really hard. We're going to confiscate whatever. They're going to do some crazy stuff.
But the maximum, like, but that maximum stake is like buried in the T's and C's, which nobody reads.
Often it is.
And that's also the issue, right? So,
like, there are some good operators out there that make it really bold, really clear. Mm. But really, if it's just in the terms, it doesn't matter how bold and clear it is, or whether it's buried on the third set of terms and conditions. If it's only in the terms and conditions, and if it's not enforced at the point of play, it's going to cause friction. Yeah. And it's going to cause friction with your genuine players, not with the bonus abusers. The bonus abusers read every single term, or the bonus abuse forums. You know, they're reading everything and then putting out guides to make sure their bonus abuse community stay within the terms. Mm. So if you're penalizing people on breaching terms, it's mostly the genuine players that you're penalizing. And that's... Yeah. And not that's, what that's you want to do as a business.
Not how you grow your business, right? That's horrible.
We see like companies that will suffer bonus abuse, and so they'll change their wagering requirements. They'll be like, okay, we've had quite friendly 30 times turnover on our bonus. We're getting exploited. How can we reduce the value of our bonusing costs? Well, let's make it 50, 60 times turnover. They do that, and that affects all their genuine players, because their genuine players now have to turn over twice as much. But the bonus abusers, if they've got the right abuse strategies, they just get around this anyway, and they carry on exploiting it. The casino goes, well, putting it from 30 times to 60 times made a bit of a difference, but not enough. Let's put it to 100 times. And if you do the maths on that for a genuine player, you're doomed. You're going nowhere with that ever, and you're just going to lose all your money. But the bonus abusers will still exploit it. And we just see these kind of things where operators don't fully understand the issues they're facing. They take the wrong actions to try and resolve it. And it's often poorly managed. And it comes down to all the same things: a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, a lack of systems, a lack of data visibility. Mm. And that's really it.
Yeah. Who does it? Like, okay. So, cause like things like making it really obvious for the user, making sure they're like, who does a great job at that? Like, who could you highlight as a good example?
I think there are various different companies that do quite well. I mean, I don't really want to go naming companies because many of them we've worked with directly.
Okay.
And some of them I'm probably just going to be wrong on because I know it from 2 years ago, right?
Got it. Okay.
But there are some companies that enforce these things at the point of play, so you physically can't breach the terms. There are some that make the terms so bold and clear, you have to literally click the box that says what the term is to confirm your understanding, or confirm a choice between two different options where the terms are blatant and clear. But it's an ever-evolving thing, right? In the UK, which is very heavily regulated, very kind of in the favor of the player. The terms and conditions are clearer, they're bolder, they're more at the forefront than they used to be. That's not to say it's an even playing field. Some operators still kind of do their best to hide things away. But in different jurisdictions where there's less regulation, then of course, you know, the industry is the way that it is. They will bury the terms away because they don't have to make it prevalent. So you get a mixture.
And then they're just not going to cash you out anyway if they don't want to. So it's just like...
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's so you're not the first type of, so obviously you guys are digital. Have you ever met Richard Marcus? He's a old friend of the podcast, and Richard is a fascinating guy, and he traveled the world exploiting land-based casinos, and he's also turned gatekeeper or gamekeeper, and he now runs the Casino Table Game Protection Conference in Las Vegas. So he gets all the land-based guys out and does kind of like, so a lot of it, like he had, it was like Ocean's 11, where like the different kind of chip things and the chip manipulation, and like they all had like names.
You're like talking about a friend of the podcast, Richard Marcus.
Yeah, I am.
But no, I know of other people that have similar backgrounds that would exploit land-based or exploit the kind of physical slot machines you get in pubs, that kind of stuff. And that there are so many similar stories or similar correlations between what other people have done. And it's all really fascinating. You know, whenever there's a way to make a profit, regardless of where it fits on someone's moral scale, there will always be some people exploiting it.
We'll have to introduce you guys, because I think there's a really nice, I think for his conference and stuff in the future, I think there's a really nice, particularly the way America's gone with the online, just that kind of overlap between, okay, you've got to run the casino, but now you've also got to worry about your online slots as well. I think it's super interesting. And yeah, that's fascinating.
I'll just chip in and say, like, what we often find actually was many of the land-based casinos that then built their own online platforms, they tend to be the absolute worst and the slowest at resolving these issues, right? They either don't fix them or they take the longest to fix them. There's obviously not everyone's the same, but there's a big trend towards, if they were land-based originally and went online, they tend to be really, really bad at identifying bonus abuse. I'm not sure, like, you know, I can understand if your expertise is land-based and you go online because it's the next logical step for your business, of course it is, right? But if you don't specialize in online casino, it is a bit of a different ball game. It really is.
Yeah, because it's a different mindset as well, because if you're a land-based casino, you physically know your players, like you can sit there and watch them.
Also, like, a land-based casino is based on the land, whereas, you know, online is kind of, it's in the sky.
It's literally in the cloud. Clouds.
Exactly. Well, that's what that means.
Is it?
I think so. I'm no expert.
And I don't know if you can talk about it or not, but is there like current big trends in the world of casino abuse, bonus abuse?
Trends are just different everywhere, right? All the same behaviors, like the different strategies of bonus abuse, broadly speaking, don't change very often or very fast. The same things that can be done now could be done 5-10 years ago. But the trends tend to change in, like, if you have a prevalent form of bonus abuse in whatever country right now, when that country starts to implement things to tackle that issue, then they'll see a different trend. The players will start going to a different form of bonus abuse, or they'll kind of spread out and do, you know, a handful of different things. So you'll see different trends in different places. You know, if you go to America right now, obviously it's all up and coming at the moment. All of their terms and conditions are really kind of user friendly. They have lower wagering requirements, bigger bonuses, and it's really quite nice if you're a consumer there, and it's especially nice if you're a bonus abuser there. But the bonus abuse community doesn't need to be particularly savvy, because the money's just there on the table. You've only got to turn your bonus over 5 times, for example, it'll turn to cash. There's no need to hunt out some clever process that will make that slightly more efficient. Whereas if you take a more established, like the UK,
Sorry about that. It was an alarm.
Are you late?
But yeah, if you take the UK, for example, like the terms here are really quite heavy. You know, you're probably 40 times turnover is probably the average. And so there's so much more scope for finding ways of optimizing the bonus value within that. That you get completely different trends. So America doesn't really have complex bonus view strategies being used right now because there's no need. But over time, as they make their terms stricter and stricter, that will happen. As regulation kicks in that prevents certain processes, you know, behaviors will change on the back of that.
So it's your classic kind of, like if you, probably antivirus is a great example of just, it's just an arms race. So as the operators get more sophisticated, the abusers get more sophisticated, and just everybody just keeps leveling up.
100%. In terms of, and this applies to all types of risk management, right? In terms of the kind of registration risks and the technical setups that people have, that's absolutely a cat and mouse process. In terms of the gameplay stuff, it kind of has been, but it doesn't need to be. And with Greco now on the market, that's going to become a thing of the past. A shameless
nice.
Plug right here.
Nice. Why do you see what he just slid that in, John?
It's the correct answer to your question, though, right? In terms of if you had an amazing system that checked for all behaviors all of the time, then there's no gaps, right? You can't magic up a new strategy that would cheat a system if the Greco product right there is checking for all the behaviors, because whatever you do, you're going to get caught straight away. And that's why we've built Greco, because no one else does this. I think there's very few other people that have the knowledge that we do that could even try and build this. And it is then a complete solution. And when it comes to the behaviors, like I said, you can't just create a new behavior. There needs to be a fundamental change somewhere that would allow a new bonus abuse process. So if you go back in the UK, I forget how many years ago it was now, but there was the regulation change which said that a player must always be able to withdraw their cash. So if you deposit and you take a bonus, you can get halfway through your bonus and go, do you know what? I'm going to cancel my bonus and withdraw my cash. That was regulation that came in. And so loads of casinos had to change their systems to cater for that. Some of them would just take your cash, delete it from your account and credit it back as a bonus and go, here's a bonus on top, off you go. That was suddenly no longer allowed, right? So they had to change their systems and processes. And then what most of the industry went to in the UK was like a cash first consumption order. So you deposit your cash, you get your bonus, you've got to play and lose your cash before you can play the bonus. Brilliant. So from the casino's perspective, the mentality is, well, if a player has to lose their cash before they can have a bonus, we can give them a massive bonus because it means they've got to lose loads of cash before they can have that. That then suddenly triggers loads of new bonus abuse processes, which look to safeguard the cash. So they're not losing the cash, they're just parking it somewhere. You know, they're betting it out on a sports book bet, and they're going to cover that bet on a betting exchange. Now they've just got this massive casino bonus sat there ready to be exploited, and win or lose, they haven't lost their cash. And so it's a change in a fundamental change like that can bring about new processes of bonus abuse. There's new content that comes out that has new mechanisms within a slot game, for example, that can exploit a bonus. And that's the kind of stuff we're always checking for. You know, we're testing games all the time. It's kind of painful.
It makes sense, because every time, like, the dev team even just does a website update that touches something, you're like,
yeah,
I don't know. Like, I've seen a lot of bullshit like accidentally introduced. The other one I've read about in the paper was the, like, get yourself self excluded, then sneak back in, and then if you're losing, pull the self exclusion card and get everything refunded.
Yeah, there was definitely a trend of that not too many years ago, and it's clever. It plays on self-exclusion, it plays on responsible gambling.
You just go straight to the Daily Mail if they say no, right? It's beautiful.
Exactly.
Like, you've got the trump card. It's amazing.
We see all sorts of processes. Like, there's a whole thing, it's big in some European countries, the kind of forget me in your data kind of process. You'd be like,
oh, nice.
Bonus abuse, get flagged as a bonus abuser, told to forget my data, a week later I come back again because you don't know who I am. There's so many things like this, right? That are quite clever, to be honest. I quite admire the
I finally found a use for GDPR. Finally, there's actually a reason for GDPR apart from clicking accept all cookies all the time. That's amazing. I like that. I love it.
Have you thought to bring up any pertinent questions about Ed's viewing choices?
I haven't, John. I haven't. I was going to leave that to you.
Oh, I suppose you've just been asking all the fucking grown-up business questions. Didn't save any of those for me, did you?
Sorry, mate. I'm greedy like that.
Ed?
Yeah?
You ever watched Cobra Kai?
I have watched a bit of Cobra Kai.
Which bit?
Series 1. I think all or most of Series 2. But I'm terrible with TV, so I kind of get disinterested unless it's literally the best thing ever. And it was very, very good. But it's not quite the best thing ever, sorry. Sorry if I've hurt your feelings.
No, I mean, that's fine. What would be the best thing ever, then?
Great question. Something that had my attention from start to finish, Stranger Things.
Okay, yeah.
I've never watched Stranger Things. Would you guys recommend it?
It is excellent. And it also, one of my favourite things about Stranger Things is it's all so very 80s themed and it does it very, very well.
Is it like a horror kind of thing? Or
It has elements of horror, but it's not in a scary way.
Okay. I don't like being scared.
I wouldn't describe it as scary. There are monsters and shit now and again.
Yeah, but you love, like,
horror movies. It's impending doom. It depends if that gets you or not.
I don't know if I need that at the end of the day.
They've nailed the kids' relationships, and you so give a fuck about the kids in it. And that's the key thing, right? It's like, so I read this terrific book called My Best Friend's Exorcism.
That's a great title.
Oh, the jacket of the book was done like an 80s video sleeve as well. I mean, it was really well done.
Beautiful.
I've also seen another edition which was done just like a yearbook. It's a really nicely done book. And I was sort of umming and ahhing about it because I thought it might be a bit gimmicky, might be shit. But what the writer actually did was he nailed one thing, because if you're going to do anything with teens, you have to get the relationship dynamics right. If you get the relationship dynamics right, everything else follows.
Makes sense.
And he nailed it. And there's a movie adaptation on Prime, and it's not very good.
Okay.
But the book, he does absolutely nail it. And I always say that's why Booksmart was such a terrific movie, because they actually made the relationship, the central relationship, really authentic. And Stranger Things, they've nailed the kids. They've absolutely nailed the kids. They're phenomenal. And it's worth watching just to enjoy their company.
Okay, I'll give it a go.
It is well worth watching.
If you've seen all the 80s films or the 80s TV shows, everything is pretty much a throwback to it in terms of the types of horror, the type of threats in it, the general imagery. You know, if you've seen like E.T., if you've seen all these kind of classic 80s films, Ghostbusters, the kind of classic 80s horror films as well, there's all these tie-ins. So if you know all those films, it's just constant enjoyment from that aspect of it, as well as it just being very, very good in its own right.
Also, one of the kids has an Evil Dead poster on his wall.
There you go.
But that's genuinely probably a particular reference, because there's a movie, it was probably about 1978, called The Hills Have Eyes, which is quite famous. It was very successful at the time, about some mutant cannibals living in the fucking Arizona hills who decide to feast on a family that breaks down. They don't break down. They have their car sabotaged. It's an early Wes Craven film. He went on to huge success with other stuff, mostly horror. But there's a scene in the movie, it's a particularly grueling scene in the movie, and you see that there is a Jaws poster which is sort of torn in half, halfway down the wall. Now, when Sam Raimi made The Evil Dead, there is a Hills Have Eyes poster torn in half, halfway down the wall. The theory was that in The Hills Have Eyes, Wes Craven was saying, you think Jaws scared you? I'm going to fuck you up for the rest of your life. And that was Sam Raimi saying, I love The Hills Have Eyes, but if you think that was horror, this is the real deal. And then this Evil Dead poster pops up. It's not torn in half halfway down the wall, but I kind of thought it was maybe a little nod to that.
Nice.
I went down a little rabbit hole there, sorry.
It's okay, mate. We're here for the details.
But Stranger Things is well worth watching because, so I've watched it, I've watched most of it with Fern. And so Fern was born in 87. So most of what it references is irrelevant to her. And she still really enjoyed it. So you as a whippersnapper, Fintan, you might find a lot to love in there.
Good.
Just saying.
I shall add it to the rotation.
And Ed watched every one. I think the last season is next year.
Yeah, I believe so. It should be good. I will say though, the only criticism is that the first three series, like the structure of them, it's just the same kind of, you know, the ups and downs, how things happen. They have that kind of blueprint for how it's going to work. And season one, two, and three are exactly the same.
Have you seen the Harry Potter films?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people do it, and there's nothing wrong with doing it. But you notice that in Stranger Things, series one, two,
and three.
Have
you seen Star Wars?
I actually haven't.
That's the exact same movie six times. You're fine.
Fintan, it's not.
It is.
But Harry Potter, you've got six movies. I know there were seven movies, but the last one in two parts. So let's count that as one. It is six movies of, couldn't be that Voldemort bloke, couldn't possibly be him, three quarters of the way through. Well, I never. It's that Voldemort. What are the odds? Fuck me. I'm not dissing them. A lot of people out there love them. I'm probably not one of those people.
And J.K. Rowling's just sitting there, just throwing the money in the air, just like, ah.
This is probably going to make me sound like a bad person. I tried reading the books, and I didn't go into it in a snobby way because I actually read quite a lot of young adult fiction. And I made it 27 pages, and I just could not find the rhythm of it at all. I just thought it needed a fucking editor.
I listened to a podcast interview with an American author who did a kid series of books that were like, I can't remember the name, but it was like hugely successful. And he was breaking down the business model, and he deliberately targeted young adults. And the parallels between what he did and the Harry Potter series is fascinating. So the first book in the series is really like, it's genuinely aimed at 10-year-olds. Right. So, and if you look at the first, like, so it's kind of like, it's a shorter book, big print, easy words, and a good story. But what you can do then is you can do a book tour of schools. Right. So your marketing isn't trying to, so you're basically allowed to go into a school and talk about your book because it's promoting literacy and doing all this kind of stuff. So what he did then was he did this massive campaign of just book tours to schools. And just get the sales out, right? So all the kids buy a book and all that kind of stuff. And then as the series progresses, you kind of start scaling up for the adults, the adult readers. And so there's a whole kind of progression series of you start here, do the school tour, build that kind of core audience. So all the kids who bought the first one are going to buy the second one. This obviously assumes it's a decent story. And then you scale up and then start hitting the adult readers who kind of get into it as well. And it was just completely cynical and marvelous in equal kind of things of I'm missing loads of details now, but just there was an entire runway of stuff to sell books to kids.
I totally get it. And you know, you have to assume that your audience is aging if you are writing a series over time and they become a very different reader. And the great example of that is the How to Train Your Dragon series.
Yes.
Which, you know, starts off super simplistic, but the last probably five books, I think, were excellent, really excellent. And, you know, reread them over the course of probably about a year. I was reading them with the kids. And they weren't actually that invested in the ones with all the fart jokes, except, you know, my kids are pretty young and they do love a good fart. So I thought they'd be mad for that, but it was the older ones that they really loved. They really, really got invested. So, you know, but I see what you're saying. So my mate Liz wrote, her first book was a young adult book. And, you know, and that was kind of her foot in the door to writing books. And now she's doing adult stuff.
Books for adults, not...
Oh, yeah, not adult leisure publishing, which we've covered in previous podcasts.
Ladyborn.
But if anybody is looking for a good young adult book, I do recommend Bear Mouth by Liz Hyder. It's won, I think it won every award it was up for except one.
It's a good one.
Also been published in North America. And it's been a long, long time since I've read a book, finished it and said, I've never read a book like that before.
That's cool.
Well, it's super clever. It's about kids working in mines. And this kid's pretty much been raised in the mine. They don't come out after their shift. They live in the mine, which is pretty accurate as to how things were a couple of hundred years ago. But having been raised in a mine for manual labor, this girl, the narrator, the first person narrator, is not very literate. But one of the other miners is teaching her how to read and write. And so the language progresses with the story.
That's cool. That's really clever.
It's fucking brilliant.
Must be hard to write. That's really clever.
I would think it would probably be very, very hard to write. And I've no idea how she did it. But I do remember reading it and just thinking, oh, that'll be why I've never published a book. I'm not good enough. Yeah. It's like I saw it when I saw Eminem in that tiny little village hall. And I just remember, like, one of the journos that I was there with, I just turned to him and I said, it's suddenly really obvious why Robbie Williams will never crack America. And he's like, why is that? So he's not good enough. It's like Eminem on stage and Robbie Williams on stage. There's no comparison. Not even close.
Reminds me of a book. I did lie when I said I can't read. I can read. I'm just not very good at it.
Anybody that has listened to the whole episode, that was before we started recording. Ed claimed to not be able to read, so he couldn't read the script.
Because he's refused to read the script for the podcast, and we're clearly furious.
So if this seems a bit wingier than normal, that's why.
Yeah, he's just let the team down.
A book called The Book of Dave. And I've never hated anything in life quite so much as I hate this book. So if you're thinking like, oh, what's really going to wind me up this weekend, go and read The Book of Dave.
Will Self.
Like, the concept of it is brilliant, but reading it is the most painful experience. Like, I think it's, I forget it, it was a long time ago now. I've tried to block it out as much as possible. But I think it's based on like this kind of future society that's living off the scraps of literature and bits they could find from the olden days. And there was this book, I think it's by like a London cabbie or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And so it's their future society is based on this book that this London cabbie was writing. So it's all the London lingo and stuff like this. And it's just really difficult to read because every other word in it is a made up word. And you have to try and remember what these words mean. And it's difficult.
Well, interestingly, Will Self also wrote one of, there's probably only three books I've not finished once I've started them in my entire life. And Will Self was one of them. I can't remember what it was called. And I was talking to Liz, who wrote Bear Mouth, about this. I was saying, I appreciate he's probably a really, really good writer, but I don't really want to read a writer who just is utterly self-congratulatory with every sentence. I don't need to read a writer who's just saying every sentence, look at how clever I am. I want a story I can get lost in. And Liz summed it up really nicely. I think it was a sentence a friend had said to her. She said, he obviously writes from the neck up. that is a great insult. It sounds shit, and I'm not going to read it because it's Will Self. Fuck the Book of Dave, frankly.
Fuck Will Self.
Well, with his infamy for his heroin taking antics. My God, what a thing to be famous for. I shot up heroin on the same plane as Princess Diana.
Amazing. But I'm glad it's not just the book. It's actually the author that's the common problem.
Yeah,
it makes me feel better.
It was a shock to me because, like I say, I bought one of his books and like you just said, it was, you know, I bought it because the premise was terrific. And I read quite a lot, and I read a lot of different styles. I read a lot of fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, and you know, I like it. I like a good book. It was How the Dead Live that I bought, and I made it. Yeah, no, maybe 30 pages before I was just like, yeah.
Interestingly, that's more that's further than you got with Harry Potter, though.
Yeah, I really stuck with it. I think it's because I think when I bought How the Dead Live, I think, let me just see, when was that published? I might be able to tie this down to a particular. How the Dead Live was published in 2000. So what's that? 23 years ago. So I'd have been 25. Yeah, I was doing a fair amount of, I was living in London. I was doing a reasonable amount of commuting. So I would have had the opportunity to read it on trains.
Makes sense.
So, you know, I probably gave it 30 pages. That's probably a day. It was Hammersmith to Victoria and then Victoria down to Battersea. To work at the empire that is QVC. Those were the days. But anyway, I digress. So, look, you've still got a bit of time to catch up with Cobra Kai before the final season, which I believe is landing later this year. It's worth it. It's worth it.
I will go back to it. I will. I am absolutely terrible with TV. I do work too much. I don't watch enough TV, but I try.
I was
he's just laid that in there when the CEO listens back to make sure he was on message for the whole thing. Just slip in a little, like, you know, work too much. Don't have time for TV.
Honestly, like, don't I have time had a 3-hour nap the other day, but I think that was the weekend.
My favorite one was the look of utter disgust on Tom Waterhouse's face when John asked him that question, like, have you watched Cobra Kai? Because you could just tell from Tom, so Tom's an Australian VC, but like third generation bookmaker. And he's done very successful stuff in Australia with online gambling. And you could just tell his brain just couldn't imagine a world where you would do anything but watch sport and gamble on sport at the same time. He just couldn't figure, you could just tell like leisure TV just doesn't, like, why would you do that when there could be like a cricket match on or a football match? It was
that
brilliant.
That is why I am poor and he is not.
That's why he's got a big VC fund. yeah, and we don't.
That's where, if we want to just, it's in the details.
it's how do you use your time?
But I'm okay with that. Because the idea of being, because I genuinely did work until about 8:30, 9 o'clock last night.
Yeah, but when you started like 7.
Yeah, I did. That is true.
Let's be honest.
I had a lie until 6. And eventually I had to get up because the dog was trying to scratch the door. I worked late last night and I did take a break in the day to take the dog out for a walk and that, but you get that, you know, you get to that sort of time, you're like, I could actually happily just go to bed now. Well, that's a shit day, isn't it? Yeah, you two with your C-level things. You're like,
it depends.
Sounds like a regular day.
It does sound like a regular day. But it just depends whether you feel like you've done stuff that you have to do or stuff you really want to do.
It was very much have to do, yeah. Very much.
Well, there's two to-do lists, right? There's urgent and then there's important. And
yeah.
You got to always try and strike a balance between the two.
I've actually got 4 to-do lists, but what I'm doing is I'm striking a balance by ignoring them all equally.
That's also a strategy.
It's going really well.
Everything's been ignored. Well, I'm getting your newsletter. The Gaming Boardroom newsletter comes out every day.
That is a good thing. We changed how we do that because we found that we were getting sources clumping because of the timings of when people put things out. and we'd set it up to be automatically populated.
Yeah, no, it's really so good.
Now it's hand selected.
It's quite quickly become a must read, which is quite fun. So well
done. You know what? That was the feedback I got at ICE from people that were reading it. Obviously, I didn't get that from people that weren't reading it. But a couple of people said that, and I'm not bullshitting here. I'm not bigging up something I do. A couple of people said that actually, you know, they're still reading the various B2B sources, but they only have to open one newsletter in the morning.
It's nice because you skim through it and you kind of go, oh, I definitely want to read that one and that one. And then maybe other stuff's not, you know, relevant for me, but you could, like, every day I found something where I'm like, oh, that's, what's that? And then kind of click through.
So how do I sign up to get this?
Well, that's a great question. Great question. And he does read the script. See that?
He's just finally got to that bit. So you go to www.thegamingboardroom.com and you sign up for associate membership, which is free. And it gives you access to a gambling news feed, which is pretty good. It's not actually, it's really fucking good, which is culled from thousands of sources. And the daily newsletter. There's also going to be a curated newsletter, which might come this week, might come next week. I'm not sure yet.
Well, I'm excited. I'm going to go and sign up for that right now.
I think that is a great thing to do, Ed. And I think anybody that's listening should probably also do that.
Can you tell me that URL again?
That is...
That's the media training kicking in. I like it.
www.thegamingboardroom.com.
I'm there right now. It looks very nice.
Associate membership, free. And there'll be some other free stuff coming. It's time, isn't it? You can't work till 8:30 every night. Well, I mean, you two can. I can send some of my stuff over if you want to. Nah, I'll get my coat. Ed Dickerson, thank you very, very much for joining us and being an expert in what seems like a relatively small space at the moment, but one that is probably pretty important.
Every operator needs to get checked.
I like to think so. I'm looking forward to the day when I can go to ICE and I can ask people, so which gameplay risk engine do you use? And there'll be more than one option. Well, when we change it into a niche, into this big vertical that everyone has and needs, I've completed it.
I like that.
It's a hell of a goal. It's almost a noble goal.
It is. I'd be like, oh, how can I create a monopoly out of this? How can I create the next GeoComply and just like tax everybody a little bit? Beautiful. Love that business.
Yeah.
But they did lose a court case though, so maybe not. We'll see.
That's just one though.
It's a big one. from what I can tell, I'm not an expert. We should call them. It's a great business. All right, Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just @GamblingFiles. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.